The Space Show, bringing the universe home to the Bayside, Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m.
Welcome to episode 3 of our Space Show documentary series, Cosmos. The television series Cosmos began in 1980 on September the 28th. In 13 weekly episodes, narrated by Carl Sagan, it told a wide-ranging story of the universe, our solar system, the evolution of life on Earth, and the history of science. That initial broadcast was seen by an estimated audience of 150 million people, which in 1980 was 3% of the global population. My, hasn't the population grown since then? Well, in many broadcasts and releases on videotape, laserdisc and DVD, millions more people have seen Cosmos in the 40 years since. So let's hear a little bit of that opening music that introduced the series. There are 100 billion galaxies and 1 billion trillion stars. Carl Sagan makes us a witness to a cosmos resplendent with beauty and perhaps rippling with life. It is an awesome reminder of the power and subtlety of the laws of nature and the triumph of cosmic evolution. Well, Vangelis's Anton Taylor-Chienoboya was chosen to underscore this idea. Most people are stirred by contemplating the cosmos. Looking outward to the grandest of mysteries returns us to ourselves. As our understanding deepens, so does our awe. Cue in the traditional Bulgarian shepherdess's song. Science is a collective enterprise that binds the generations in an ongoing venture to discover the nature of the universe. Carl Sagan said we embody the local eyes and ears and thoughts of the cosmos. Our obligation to survive is owed not just to ourselves, but also to that ancient and vast cosmos from which we spring. Reprise, Vangelis's Heaven and Hell. There are several versions or edits of the television series Cosmos. The original, shown in 1980 by the PBS network, had episodes that were 60 minutes long. The version shown in the United Kingdom by the BBC had each episode cut down to 50 minutes. And that was the version broadcast in Australia and New Zealand. For reruns on commercial television, a further 5 minutes were hacked out, making each episode 45 minutes. And this is the version that is available on Laserdisc and the early DVDs. For many years, the full 60 minutes per episode version did not appear to be available anywhere, not even as bootleg copies. Remember that in 1980, very few people had video cassette recorders, so surviving private copies of the original would be as rare as hen's teeth. However, an Ultimate Edition DVD is now available as a 5-disc set, and this approximates the original PBS version. It has a delightful introduction by Anne Druyan, who co-wrote the series.
Hello, my name is Anne Druyan. When Carl Sagan, Steven Soder, and I wrote the Cosmos television series in the late 1970s, a lot of things were different. Back then, the United States and the Soviet Union held the whole planet in a perpetual hostage crisis called the Cold War. The wealth and scientific ingenuity of our civilization was being squandered on a runaway arms race that employed more than half the world's scientists and infested the Earth with 50,000 nuclear weapons. So much has happened since then. The Cold War is history, and science has made great strides. We've completed the spacecraft reconnaissance of the solar system, the preliminary mapping of the visible universe that surrounds us, and we have charted the universe within, the human genome. When Cosmos was first broadcast, there was no World Wide Web. It was a different world. What a tribute to Carl Sagan, a scientist who took many a punch for daring to speculate that even after 20 of the most eventful years in the history of science, Cosmos requires few revisions and indeed is rich in prophecy. Cosmos is both a history of the scientific enterprise and an attempt to convey the soaring spiritual high of its central revelation, our oneness with the universe. Now please enjoy Cosmos, the proud saga of how, through the searching of 40,000 generations of our ancestors, we have come to discover our coordinates in space and in time, and how, through the awesomely powerful method of science, we have been able to reconstruct the sweep of cosmic evolution and to find our own part in its great story.
That was Anne Druyan's introduction to the DVD re-release of Cosmos. The official name for the program was Cosmos, A Personal Voyage, and it was written by Carl Sagan, Anne Druyan, and Steven Soder. In 1980, at the time of the release of the television series and the book Cosmos, Carl Sagan was the director of the Laboratory for Planetary Studies and Professor of Astronomy and Space Sciences at Cornell University. He had been involved in the Mariner, Viking, and Voyager unmanned expeditions to the planets, and Sagan had received numerous scientific and literary reports. Now, in association with the television series, Carl Sagan wrote a 365-page book which reinforced and expanded on the themes of the television episodes. It had over 250 full-color illustrations and numerous black and white photographs, drawings, and maps. In 1986, Carl Sagan visited New Zealand to observe Halley's Comet. Television New Zealand asked me to draft some questions they might ask our esteemed visitor, and I duly submitted some. Well, in the end, they only used one of my questions.
And welcome to the Tonight Show. My guests tonight are Australian cricketer Greg Matthews, Digby Taylor, Champagne Ambassador Comte Philippe de Bourgeau, and we're going offshore too to meet astronomer Carl Sagan on board the Royal Viking Star for the Halley's Comet cruise. But first, here's brought my next guest, Dr. Carl Sagan, to New Zealand. Dr. Carl Sagan is the Professor of Astronomy and Space Studies and the Director of the Laboratory for Planetary Studies at Cornell University. You'll probably remember him as the man who popularized astronomy in his TV series Cosmos. Dr. Sagan, your enthusiasm for this comet's extraordinary. You and your wife Anne have written a book about it. It's brought you down here now. Why is it so important to you?
Well, there are many, many different reasons. One is that that Halley's Comet has been a kind of metronome that has beaten out the progress or decline of human history. Every 76 years it returns to the Earth. This is roughly a human lifetime. And so it's a convenient benchmark for how we humans are doing. The last arrival before this one in 1910 was the first return of Halley's Comet after the invention of the airplane, the last before the invention of nuclear weapons. It's an interesting way to think of it. But beyond that, it is important because comets are mementos of creation. They are the building blocks of the solar system, the pieces that fell together to make the planets, including to some extent the Earth, some 4,500 million years ago. By studying the comets, we study our own origins. Comets have been intimately connected both at the time of the origin of the Earth and subsequently with what happens down here, including our own evolution. So there's a reason to be interested in them.
Well, that's almost an academic reason. But what's the magic of the comet that grabs the Joe Bloggs?
Well, I think that science is the heritage of everyone. And if you look at the prevalence of creation myths in every culture, you see that people all over the world are interested in their own origins. It's genealogy writ large. And so I don't think the scientific reasons for interest in comets and the popular reasons are so different. It is true that there's been a long history of superstition attached to comets. Every time a comet appeared in the sky, people attributed some local disaster to it. And there are a sufficient number of local disasters that you can hang one on any comet that comes by. So we are a little bit beyond that, not fully beyond that. Certainly in 1910 there was a great wave of superstitious fervor which circulated around the planet concerned about poison gas in the tail of Halley's Comet. But that aside, comets are lovely to look at. They're unusual. They're a break from the routine of the night sky, and so attract attention for that reason. It's not hard to see that humans in the past might have thought that such a beautiful and unusual visitor is not there for no reason. It's telling us something. It's a harbinger, some message from a disgruntled deity, and we better pay attention. But today it seems to me that the interest is much better based and still deeper.
Carl, you started off as an orthodox scientist, but certainly no ordinary one, and I think we should mention that you were the first to demonstrate the production of amino acids. Also, through your radar experiments, you discovered Mars ridges, not to mention that you were also responsible for gauging the temperature on Venus. But somewhere along the way, you decided that life in that obscure laboratory wasn't for you.
Well, no, that's not true. I still have an obscure laboratory in which I obscurely work.
Why did you decide to popularize your science? Because you have done it more than anyone in history.
Well, thank you. I didn't intend to. It's just I did scientific research and gave talks at scientific meetings, and the press came to ask me to explain it, and I did it, and they liked it, and so they asked me more, so I responded more. And so after a while, I found myself talking to the press, perhaps more than other scientists do. But I suppose the real turning point for me was the Mariner 9, and especially the Viking spacecraft missions to Mars, U.S. Spacecraft that absolutely revolutionized our understanding of that wonderful planet. And television in the United States and elsewhere wasn't interested. Here we had thousands of extraordinary photographs taken from close-up of a world that no one had ever looked at before. And the television networks claimed that the average person in the United States was disinterested. I couldn't believe it. In all my talks, popular talks that I had given, I sensed an enormous repository of interest in this. So when the networks essentially decided that the public was too stupid to understand this, we decided we would give it a try. And that's the origin of the Cosmos television series. And certainly its popularity shows that people are deeply interested in scientific issues, if only they have a chance to be exposed to them.
You've said that for thousands of years we could only guess about life and outer space, but now there are experiments that can be done. How close are we to answering that tantalizing question?
Well, you can do many experiments with a no answer and not be anywhere near answering the question. You need only do one with a yes answer and you have answered the question. We have done no experiments with a yes answer yet. The Viking spacecraft that I mentioned, two of them, landed on Mars in 1976, made a rudimentary but by no means unsophisticated search for life and found absolutely nothing. No sign on Mars, a planet in some sense like the Earth, of anything we would call living now. Maybe we asked the wrong questions or looked in the wrong place or at the wrong time, but as far as we can tell, that planet and the moon that we've also been to are lifeless. There are many other worlds in the solar system. It's possible there's life on some of them, but there's not a hint of evidence that's the case. The other thing we can do is to use large radio telescopes to see if anyone is sending us a radio message, someone on a planet of some far distant star. And there is now evidence that there are many planets. That planets are very abundant in the Milky Way galaxy. This sort of search is just at its earliest stages. A systematic attempt to seek out such signals is in its earliest stages. But radio technology is so sophisticated that it's possible to do an extremely thorough search over the next 10 or 15 years, and it looks as if such a search will be performed.
Carl, you're one of the few in the space industry who has publicly questioned the validity or morality of the Star Wars program. Why?
I think a large number of people have questioned Star Wars. For myself, its advocates admit that it will not do what President Reagan asked for, namely a kind of shield that would protect the civilian population of the United States against a Soviet nuclear attack, because they say that perhaps after the expenditure of enormous sums of money in some decades, the United States might have a system which could shoot down 90% of Soviet warheads. The Soviets have 10,000 warheads. Shoot down 90% of them leaves 1,000 warheads that would explode on American soil. 1,000 warheads exploding on American soil is enough to destroy the United States utterly. So even by the numbers of the proponents of Star Wars, the system cannot work in the sense of protecting the American population. Beyond that, the Soviets have many options available to them, including increasing their inventory of offensive forces if they wish to overwhelm Star Wars, to develop decoys and what are called penetration aids, to fly under the system. And therefore, the advantage will always be, so it seems, on the offensive forces. So this is foolish, and it can't work. It can only promote an additional ratchet up of the disastrous nuclear arms race, and in fact is likely to increase, not decrease, the chances for nuclear war. So I would much, coming out to the point you just raised, I would much rather see these immense resources used to help that fraction of the world's people that don't have enough to eat, or where there's absurdly high infant mortality, for education, and a tiny residuum of that money, that $1 trillion, that $1 billion, an amazing amount of money, just a tiny fraction of that would be sufficient to do
to do the most wonderful additional explorations of the solar system by robots and by people.
Dr. Sagan, thank you, and good sky watching.
Thank you, and to you.
Speaking in Auckland in 1986, that was Carl Sagan. He died 10 years later in 1996, aged 62. Well, the script for this evening's The Space Show was adapted by myself, Andrew Rennie, from notes written by Jeffrey Haynes-Styles and Anne Dryun. The music we have played is only a tiny fraction of the hundreds of pieces used in the original 13 hours of the PBS production. For copyright reasons, the VHS, Laserdisc and DVD releases of Cosmos sometimes used different music. Now, we here have used the music as released in 1980 on the Cosmos long-playing vinyl record. In 2014, an updated version of Cosmos was released as Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey. It was hosted by astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson and executive produced by Andrew Yoon. It was released here in Australia by Fox TV. This year, 2020, another series was released for National Geographic. Called Cosmos, Possible Worlds, it was hosted by Neil Tyson with an introduction that harkens back to the original Cosmos.
We were hunters and foragers. The frontier was everywhere. We were bounded only by the earth and the ocean and the sky. The open road still softly calls, like a nearly forgotten song of childhood. For all our failings, despite our limitations and fallibilities, we humans are capable of greatness. How far will our nomadic species have wandered by the end of the next century and the next millennium?
Welcome back to the shores of the cosmic ocean. An immensity of space and time. A vastness still mostly uncharted. We're bound for the possible worlds revealed by science. We'll take a ride on the underground worldwide network that no one knew was there. I'm going to tell you a first contact story that's true. We'll meet some of the most courageous people who ever lived. And we're going to venture into the future we can still have, to the homes of our distant descendants among the stars. Science can carry us across that vastness, but without imagination, we go nowhere. Our ship of the imagination is propelled by twin engines of skepticism and wonder. It's guided by the simple set of rules that define science and make it so powerful. Test ideas by experiment and observation. Build on those ideas that pass the test. Reject the ones that fail. Follow the evidence wherever it leads and question everything. Take these rules to heart and the cosmos is yours. Come with me.
The Beginning of Cosmos, Possible Worlds. It was written and produced by Andrian. It's hosted by Neil deGrasse Tyson. The music is by Alan Silvestri. And, well, I've seen four episodes of it so far. I find it very good. And it is available to purchase on DVD, and presumably you can also find it on various streaming services. Well, we have more about Cosmos coming up. Greek musician Vangelis wrote some of the music used in Cosmos. Now, perhaps you don't realise that he wrote at least six compositions that were not used in the television series. Here they are.